She goes once. She makes it an annual habit for more than 30 years and still cannot get enough. Stay tuned. Good afternoon. I am Chrissy Hewitt. Issues and Ideas continues now with Ears on Art, a twice-monthly segment devoted to the exploration of the visual arts. My co-host, Stephen DeLuque, and I produce it here at the studios of KCBX Public Radio for the California Central Coast. This May, I attended the annual Society of North American Goldsmiths Conference. This organization, often referred to as SNAG, moves its conference around the country, and this year it was held in the Phoenix, Scottsdale area. My guest today is Betsy Douglas, a fellow attendee, and I'll tell you a little bit more about her in a moment. SNAG has been in existence for over 40 years and was developed so that both educators and students, as well as others who would be interested, would have a forum where they could get together and discuss the world of metalsmithing. This year, there were over 600 attendees enjoying lectures, demonstrations, and a chance to purchase wonderful items in the vendors' room. My guest, Betsy Douglas, has not missed a conference in over 30 years. She's now in her 70s, and is dealing with a variety of health conditions. But as you will hear, these do not emotionally slow her down. My attendance has been quite sporadic in comparison, but I do know that when I get there, I will always be able to find Betsy. As you will hear, she is a designer metalsmith, and I will tell you, of considerable talent. It is her enthusiasm that knows no bounds, and I believe that her story helps to remind us of the pure joy of involvement, of doing what you love. We had our conversation in one of the hotel lobbies, and I'm only sorry that you can't see the pure delight on Betsy's face when she talks. But I think you can hear it. Join me now with Betsy Douglas. Good afternoon.
Hi, Krista. It's fun to see you again. We've been going to conferences for a long time. This is my 35th conference for the Society of North American Goldsmiths. And the first year I went was with Mary Ann Scheer, whom I was studying with back at Kent State Jewelry, where I had left off being a student at Skidmore College with Earl Pardon in the late 50s. And that was 1977 with Mary Ann. And it was so exciting to meet these people whom I had discovered in the field in person. And I'm like the bad penny who keeps showing up because this group of talented artists have really become family to me. And what's really super is that there's a lot of students here. So the passion and the fun continues. It's meant a great deal to me to have this interaction and discovery of ideas and information. I'm just like a big sponge. I just love it. It makes you go home and you think, oh, yeah, I could do that. And opens all kinds of possibilities. And that's why I keep coming back. And one of the things that I have done over the years for SNAG, in a way, is become an unofficial historian. I collected all of the early magazines and what have you. The conferences started in 1970, and I didn't show up to 77. And then in 88, they wanted someone to do a 20-year history of the organization. So I did it. in getting all this information, I learned so much about the people, what happened, the sharing of ideas. One thing about our field that is terrific is that we share. We are not precious about our knowledge. We say, oh, I can show you how to do that. I one time, for example, sat at Betty Harris's kitchen table and learned how to crochet wire to make a bolo tie, and Betty taught me how. And then I turned around and taught students of Anne Graham's in the University of Delaware how to do it. I only knew one stitch, but I was able to pass it along. But someone who also learned it from me has become an amazing artist in her own right and figured out a whole nother way of doing it. So that's been terrific. That's the kind of experience you can have and take with you.
I really agree, and I think that sharing of ideas, it's easy to make the association with people who share recipes, because you get the recipe and maybe you think you've made it the same way, but it usually tastes a little bit different somehow, whatever we do.
Well, you bring to it your own way of thinking.
Exactly. So giving somebody that information doesn't mean that you have given all of your secrets away. You've shared knowledge.
You've planted a seed.
And these conferences, they're national, they're international. We have people here certainly from Canada all the time, but also from Europe sometimes. And it's 4 days of listening to people talk about their work, showing images of their work, doing some demos, and of course for some of us, spending a lot of time buying things.
I showed restraint this year. I only bought one book in the vendor's room, and because I am a person of maturity, I don't need any more tools like I used to. I've simplified my processes to the point where I now use a 56 drill bit and little eyeglass screws and nuts, and that's how I put things together.
Where did it start for you, Betsy?
Oh, gosh, I had a jewelry class as a junior at Skidmore College with Earl Pardon in 1957 and graduated in 58, and then waited 20 years after having three sons and went back to school in my middle 40s and got a master's in fine art in metalwork at Arizona State University. And that changed my life because suddenly I was a new kid on the block at the age of 50 and had all this excitement about creating. And I made it a conscious decision not to be a production artist. I'm a very successful failure. I decided to make things that I truly loved and enjoyed doing. And I've kept to that pretty much from that point on.
And you have even exhibited in San Luis Obispo.
That's true. Chris invited me to participate one time, and I had a good time being there. And I'm glad. And when we come back through, I have fond memories of my experience there.
That I think was in 89 or 90.
Yeah. Recently, I have simplified my processes, and I'm recycling now. I'm using obsolete computer lead frames from old-time technology, as they look like lace to me in metal, and computer circuitry and boards that I've cut up and used as elements of design in pendants and a collar. The piece I'm going to wear tonight for the dance is called Cleo's Collar, and it looks Egyptian, but it's circuitry and old mechanical gears. So
what a great past and present and future all tied into one.
Yeah, I used to work in a lot in silver, and I've done many, many things, but the eyesight isn't as great. The hands aren't as steady, so you do what you can do.
Oh, exactly. And what I remember about your silver work that I found particularly intriguing at the time was, at least during one stage, you were very involved with a very pearly kind of satin finish that,
yes,
I know was not easy to acquire and not that easy to maintain, but it sure is
it's
beautiful. It's
not easy to maintain. You have to dip your stuff, your pieces. But it's building up a fire scale, and I was folding thin metal, and there's no way you could get inside to clean those pieces or buff them. And I don't like shiny anyway. I like it to look soft and mellow, and that's the way I got the results. But they are kind of a nuisance to clean.
Fire scale, folks, is the... we always talk about working in silver, but most of us are working in sterling. And sterling's an alloy of 925 parts silver and 75 parts copper. And that 75 parts copper is what tarnishes, even though we always think that it's silver tarnishing, but it isn't. And when we heat it, the copper oxidizes, and when we're sanding a piece to polish it, you'll start seeing this wonderful purple sort of blotchy surface.
That's right, and it isn't pretty, so...
Some people like to try to think it is, but it really isn't.
My guest Betsy Douglas and I rambled on a little bit more about this. Either one is sanding through this layer of copper oxide, or one is building up a layer of pure silver. And the way we do that is to immerse the piece, while it's hot, into a solution that we affectionately call pickle. It's a mild acid solution, sometimes made with sulfuric acid and water, and nowadays a much friendlier version has been created for studio use. And after you do this several times, this pure silver, which looks quite white and, as we've already described, rather pearly, comes to the surface. Then you have to be careful, because if you start sanding on it by mistake, you'll break through it and get back to the fire scale and get to start all over.
Gosh, I mean, you're talking about a while ago. I haven't done that for a while, Chris. Even though the heat is on is the theme of this conference, and we use torches and, you know, hot processes, I'm trying to keep cool in the desert by doing cold connections.
Well, you live in these parts, so
yes, I do.
You know the heat.
I do.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Ears on Art here on KCBX Public Radio for the California Central Coast. My guest today is Betsy Douglas, who is a longtime silversmith and an avid attendee of the National Society for North American Goldsmiths Conference. We continue now as she tells us about her documentation of the annual pin swap.
I was asked to bring my pin collection. One of our traditions here each year on the opening evening is to trade pins that we've made. And the first time we did it was in 1986 at Flagstaff. I didn't make any pins, but some other people did, and I just sweet-talked certain people out of their pins. But I decided I really liked them, and I wanted to participate in this. So by 88, I started to make them. I now have, up to last year, 23 panels of pins, one of which is very small, but the rest of them are either 15 by 27 or 18 by 27, loaded with stuff that people have made, and there's treasures and there's junk. For example, one of my favorites was a Band-Aid and two aspirin with a pin back on it. Some of the pieces that people have traded are beautiful, and some of them are absolutely silly and wonderful, but it's a way of communicating. So this year I brought my entire display for people to enable them to revisit their history of pin swap.
It always fascinates me how creative people get, and I have really not participated in it. I have acquired a few over the years. You've been very generous in giving me one almost every time, and other people, but I really admire people's ability to get out there and crank out 15, 25,
well,
30 of these, you know, whatever they're doing, and you can say, well, it's inexpensive material, it's whatever, but you're still wanting something that, as you say, either has a little humor to it or a little something that leaves a mark.
I decided I really wanted to collect these pins, so I've been making 100 to take to each conference so that I could trade. What I trade for, I get. But I make sure that mine are well made, because that's inside me. I can't cut corners.
These are places where you've certainly made very good use of your involvement with, as you say, the computer boards and the other bits of technology. And so they often bring color to the piece and intricacy.
It's also my revenge on the computer. I'm a 20th century person married to a 21st century guy of 54 years, by the way. He's the one who can do the digital imaging and help me send it into a competition, and did a whole database of like a 460 some pieces that I've made since 1957.
You also were a board member for a while, correct?
Yes, I was on the board of SNAG from 1990 to 1995. I found out every time I left the room, they would give me another job.
Well, that's the practice on all good boards. If you're not there, you're nominated.
That's right.
At the board level, what kinds of concerns is the organization dealing with?
When I was on the board, I was in charge of programs for students, trying to encourage students to work just education and membership services, that sort of thing. I'm almost 76. It's no longer my responsibility where SNAG goes, but the next generations are the key. And boy, are they talented. They had a student presentation of work from schools all over the country yesterday, and it was wonderful. Talented, talented people.
And last night we went around to some galleries, and one location had 5 or 6 shows, and you'd walk from room to room and all of a sudden realize you were in a different exhibit. But one of them, which I thought was really wonderful, was President's work.
Yes.
Over the years. And what I really enjoyed about it, beyond the beauty and the talent, was the diversity. Because you could think sometimes that an organization might say, well, we really want to have people that work and therefore think in this kind of way, high polish or this or that or something. And that isn't what was happening. There's varying metals, varying styles, everything. So that was neat to see.
I agree. The magazine Metalsmith has been our main way of communicating to the world at large what metalsmiths do. In a sense, through that magazine and an earlier version, which was called the Goldsmith's Journal, we have written our own history. They have even an exhibition in print each year as one of the publications. It's been a way of reaching out to show people what's possible in our field.
And back to the word diversity, you think you've been studying something a long time and realize you've sort of scratched a little tiny corner of the surface, and that there's other technical aspects that you've never attempted, didn't even know existed.
You cannot learn it all in a lifetime. You have to pick and choose which direction you're going to take. only that comes out when you've taken time to discover. It was hard for me to figure out who Betsy Douglas really was, but finally she showed up in my work and it became more consistent, and it was obviously a very personal aesthetic expression.
Can you articulate that anymore in terms of what that journey was about?
Well, a lot of experimentation. I tried a lot of things. I went to lots of workshops. I have an amazing library of books. Anything is possible. The possibilities are endless.
In terms of your own work, I'm just thinking that if we go back to the silver pieces that we talked about before, and then now the pieces using the
computer parts,
etc., do you feel as though there is a visual connection in that work? If we were to put out a display of early Betsy and current Betsy, that people would know that it was you?
You know how Ansel Adams photographed Yosemite? Well, if you keep doing something, it becomes associated with you. I have folded metal in my early pieces. I don't know why. I did from early on. I was manipulating. And now it's totally different look. But I've been playing with the material. And that giving yourself permission to play, and it doesn't have to be art. It can be just what you want it to be. When you get to a certain age, you get away with that. You know, you don't have to prove anything anymore.
And I'm not trying to suggest that one should have a look that stays with them all their life.
So No.
You were speaking about developing an aesthetic that to you was important. And I was just curious if there are ways that you feel that even though the work might look quite different, certainly different material, how that aesthetic chain continues.
Well, if you finally figure out what it is that you really care about, it will surface and continue. But you also need to be able, as I had to because of eyesight and what have you, I now use a 5-power optimizer in order to put things together. You have to let your excitement about what you're making take you wherever it's going to be. On my card, it says Betsy Douglas, designer metalsmith. And that's probably a pretty good description, because I'm not so much doing metalsmithing now, but I am a designer from the core, because that's the way I was taught.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't go away.
No, you hope it doesn't.
No, you hope it doesn't, right.
You've made some references to the physical shape of eyes and so forth, and I find it, you know, truly impressive in terms of just, I'm going to keep doing this no matter what kind
of
attitude.
It's because I need to. It is part of who I am. When I studied way back at Skidmore, I went to my 50th reunion, and they asked us to write about our Skidmore experience, and I said, well, it was just the beginning. The seeds that were planted by Earl Pardon came out in fruition much later and continued. Because you do change, life's experiences take you this way or that way. If you listen to yourself and let yourself be yourself, I think that it's really honest and it shows up in what you make. And I hope to always be a maker. When I can't see anymore, and that might happen to me, I will have done the best I could. As long as I can figure out a way to make something, it is very, very satisfying. And that's the joy of being a maker.
It seems to be a thread that just keeps coming back and back and back, and it doesn't matter with the people that we talk to on this show, if they're painting, if they're constructing, whatever they might be doing, they're involved both in ideas, but also in the making. And that just comes out over and over. So there must be something that's very powerful to us about that.
I agree.
As you said, you keep getting renewed by coming and being around people doing...
Oh, this is a stimulation beyond. I'm having trouble keeping up the energy like I used to. I didn't miss anything when I would come to these conferences. Now I'm a little bit slower about getting around to every single thing that's happening.
It's sounding very much like for you, it's been a rich life, and you've certainly given a lot to other people to make their lives richer.
Truly, I think finding something that you care about doing is wonderful. I'm just so grateful that my life has been such. It has truly enriched my life, and I have a very patient husband and three sons who put up with mom going to college while they were teenagers, but they survived it, and so did I. And my eldest son one time said, who was in college, he said, "It's not easy, is it, Mom?" And I said, "No." But we both did it, you know, and it worked.
What's next?
Well, I'm going traveling. We are leaving in a few days for a summer journey of fun to the cooler climates. The heat is on in Arizona. We're getting out of here. And we've been doing this now since my husband retired for 8 years in a truck camper, and now we have what we call a cow, a condo on wheels, a fifth wheel, which we pull with a one-ton dual-wheel pickup truck, and we just go.
And I would imagine that all of that different scenery, environment, food, everything.
You get ideas. My husband photographs. We go to museums. We go to galleries. We check out festivals. We just have a wonderful time. And, you know, you're just getting all this information. And then I come back and I work in my studio. And it gives me, I get ideas. And that's what it's all about. And it's ideas and fun.
Well, it sounds just great. And I will be thinking about you as you travel around. And I am so glad to be seeing you this time and in your home turf, so to speak. And it's been fun over the years to know that I could pretty much count on the fact that I could run into Betsy and have a good conversation and a good laugh.
Thank you so much, Chris. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you.
You have been listening to Ears on Art, a twice-monthly segment of Issues and Ideas. My co-host Stephen DeLucchi and I produce it here at the studios of KCBX Public Radio for the California Central Coast. Stephen and I wish to take this opportunity to acknowledge two stalwart supporters of the arts in this community, whom we've lost recently. The deaths of Priscilla Graham and Clifford Chapman create a very large hole. For several decades, you knew that you would see them in person or find their name on the donor list of just about every major arts event in this county. It would certainly take much longer than we have here to do justice to their contributions. But we did want to say thank you, Clifford. Thank you, Priscilla. You gave us so much. This is Chrissy Hewitt. Thanks for listening.